Okay, welcome back. This is Jeffrey Sachs of Web Yeshiva and Mishkan Sipora in Efrat, and we are continuing our study of Masechet Ta'anit. Last week we began studying this somewhat well-known Agadah of Ilfa and Rabbi Yochanan. We kind of got arrested in the middle. So what I want to do is I want to go back and I want to read the Gemara. We'll start from scratch from the beginning of the Agadah. I'll just read straight through Dafyomi style, as it were, so that we understand the words of this Agadic passage, and then we're going to talk about it. We'll try to dissect it. We'll try to make sense of it. There are a number of well-known treatments of this Agadah, both in the classical literature and in the more modern or scholarly literature. In the classical literature, I always think, and this is how I was trained in yeshiva, that you don't ignore the Agadot, and that we often can turn to the Farshim, such as the Maharal or the Maharsha, who give insight to the Agadot, although they don't read it in the same manner as contemporary scholars. They nevertheless try to, distill the Agadah for its moral messages. And in contemporary writers, there are figures like Professor Jeffrey Rubinstein, who has some interesting things to say on this particular passage, particularly in how his concerns are trying to correlate the character of Ilfa and this particular Agadah with parallel Agadot elsewhere in Shas, and particularly in the Yerushalmi. This character of Ilfa, who is not so well known to us as students of the Bavli, is somewhat more prominent in the Yerushalmi, where he often appears under a different name of Chilfa. Ilfa, Chilfa. You can understand how those two names might get switched. And in fact, the name Ilfa, it seems to clearly be some kind of, well, it's a kind of chicken and the egg. You know, was his name Ilfa? And that's why the Agadah about him features a ship as a prominent symbol, Ilfa being the Aramaic for ship or boat, does he become nicknamed Ilfa because of this particular incident? Well, that is the stuff of speculation. Before we begin, though, Sharon is with us. Sharon from Yerushalayim. I don't recall. Did I mention last week something about this idea that the Jewish and the Gregorian calendars coincide every 19 years? I didn't remember saying that. Maybe I said it recently, but Sharon drew my attention to the fact. She drew my attention to a fact that I know, but intentionally ignored. And that fact is that what I said, that the Jewish calendar, the Jewish lunar calendar, and the Gregorian calendar coincide once every 19 years, so that your 19th birthday, some of us may remember their 19th birthday, your 19th birthday, your 38th birthday, do the math going forward, will coincide your Hebrew birthday and your English birthday. That is true, except for when it is not. It's a kind of urban legend, which is correct much of the time, more frequently than not. However, because of the vagaries of the calendar and whether or not you're born in a leap year and a few other factors, so Sharon did correctly point me to the fact that I should have put an asterisk there, and she sent me a rather learned discourse by her son, who was surprised to discover on his 19th birthday that what he had always been told was not in fact true, as proved by his own birthday. So Sharon, if you have that document, you can upload it here in the chat box and share it with everyone.
I'll try and find a link. The thing you sent me in return, I have to say, it's a lot easier to understand.
Yeah. So there's a, you can Google it. Maybe somebody who can, I can't Google and teach at the same time. It's like, drinking and driving. But maybe somebody else can Google it. Professor Ari Zivatovsky, who writes a regular column in the Jewish Action magazine called What's the Truth About or What's the Story With dot dot dot, where he debunks Jewish urban legends, this being one of them. So he has a rather straightforward column where he explains the mechanics of the calendar. So if somebody can Google that and find it, Zivotofsky calendar, 19 years, you'll, oh, there you go. David already, you can't beat David. He's quick draw McGraw. David posted the chat, the link to Zivotofsky's article, which also explains this. So again, it's true, except for when it's not. Okay, now back to Ilfa. Remember, the whole Gemara is introduced in the context of the unstable wall. We had been talking about these unstable walls and the problem of sitting underneath one, the problem of putting yourself in a dangerous position. Here, we had an earthquake here. Did anybody feel the earthquake this morning?
No.
No? You know, there was a pretty significant earthquake off the coast. And it was felt, I think Magen David Adom said they received hundreds of calls early in the morning, people who felt the earthquake. I didn't feel it out here, but apparently it was felt even in Yerushalayim. But there was a pretty significant earthquake off the coast of Crete or something that was felt all throughout the area. But you know, you understand, like you shouldn't.
Cyprus.
I meant. What did I said Crete? Yeah, I meant Cyprus. You know, the being in a dangerous structure. You know, now in Yerushalayim, not just Yerushalayim, all over the country, there's this attempt to. Well, the excuse is, the stated reason is we have to fortify old buildings because the big one is coming. We're overdue for a big earthquake, God forbid. And a lot of the old buildings will not withstand them. So they're doing all that Tama Shloshim B'Shmona where they redo the buildings, you know, are there to fortify them. You know, although to be cynical, probably the real reason is if you add on three or four stories to these buildings all throughout Yerushalayim, that's a lot more arnona the city can collect on. Even if those apartments will be occupied by Jews from Woodmere that only use them for Pesach and Sukkot, it doesn't matter because they still pay the arnona. They still pay the property tax. So this idea of the shaky walls is the hook on which this Agadah is hung. So the Gemara says that Ilfa Verbi Yochanan Havu, here we're at the top, Ilfa Verbi Yochanan Havu Garse Be'araita, Ilfa and Rabbi Yochanan were chavrusas, they studied together in yeshiva, Dechikaluhu Milta Tuva, and they were really seriously, like many young students, they were seriously financially oppressed. It was hard to support themselves. Omri, they said, Nekum v'nezil v'naved iska. Let's get up, let's go, and let's mach parnosa. Let's go make a little parnosa for ourselves. Let's support ourselves. We can't stay in yeshiva forever. Let's go out and earn a living. V'nekayim b'nafshein, and the verse shall be fulfilled in us. Efes ki lo ye b'cho evyon. It's a pasuk from Parshat Re'eh about Shemitah, actually, relevant to our current year, that says that there should be no impoverished, there should be no needy among the Jewish people. So since we are needy, we should fulfill the verse of getting rid of poverty. What's the best way to get rid of poverty? Go out and work. Azlu otve tute guda ri'io. They went out and they sat beneath a shaky wall. Havukokarche rifta. They were breaking bread. I remind you of Rav Huna just a few lines earlier. We had learned that Rav Huna, whenever he would break bread, he would, you know, call out, Kol Dichvin. Anybody who wants can come and eat. And here you have two poor people breaking their own bread, their meager meal, sitting by the wall. V'atu tre malachei sharet. And along come two ministering angels. Shmai Rabbi Yochanan, de'omar chad l'chaveiro. Rabbi Yochanan hears one angel say to the other, Nishde alayhu Hi, Guda, v'naktalinhu. Let's topple over that wall and kill these guys. Shemanichin chaye olam haba v'oskin b'chaye shoh. Why are they susceptible to death? Because they are about to abandon the eternal life of Torah study, of learning in yeshiva, in order to go out and deal with temporal matters, with this worldly affairs of earning a living. And therefore, the mitchayev benafshei, they're deserving of all punishment that comes to them. So Amar Leidach, the other angel, responds to the first, Shavkinu, no, leave them alone. De'ika buhu chad de'kaima lo sha'ato. Leave them alone, because one of them still has yet, his hour awaits him. Kaima lo sha'ata, his hour awaits him, meaning he is destined to accomplish something great, and if we kill him now, he'll never get there. So they don't kill him. And the other guy, which, in other words, one of them, the merits of one of them saves them both, which of course also harkens back to the Gemarot that we saw earlier, that idea that if there's a righteous person or a meritorious person present, no harm will come the other people that are piggybacking on his merits by being in a dangerous house or underneath a shaky wall with him, because God will not kill the meritorious, and the merely neutral people are protected because of their proximity. Rabbi Yochanan shama, Ilfa lo shama. Rabbi Yochanan heard this, overheard this conversation of the angels. Ilfa didn't hear it. Omer le, Rabbi Yochanan le Ilfa, shma mar mide, did you hear that? Omer le, lo, I didn't hear a thing. Omar midi shome ana, ve Ilfa lo shame, shma mino le didi kai malisha ata. So Rabbi Yochanan says to himself, well, since I overheard this conversation of the angels and Ilfa didn't hear a thing, presumably, Shema Mino, I presume from this that they're talking about me, that I am the one who is destined for greatness, and in the potential merit of what I will achieve, the wall was not torn down on us. And therefore he understands, Omer le Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan says to Ilfa, Ihader v'oke benafshe, ki lo yechtal evyon mikerev haaretz. He says, I'm not so sure about leaving yeshiva on second thought. I'm not so sure that I should fulfill the verse in Parshat Re'eh that there should be no poor people. Maybe I am destined for the verse a few verses later that says, no matter what you do, there's always going to be poor people. Maybe I'm destined to be poor, meaning maybe I'm destined to remain in yeshiva learning, even though it means that I will be poor. Rabbi Yochanan hadar. Rabbi Yochanan goes back to yeshiva. Ilfa lo hadar, and Ilfa didn't go back to the yeshiva. Ad atya Ilfa mlich Rabbi Yochanan. And however long later, when Ilfa returns from his being out there in the big wide world earning a living, Rabbi Yochanan had been made the melech, meaning the head of the yeshiva. Man malke rabbonon, says the Gemara, that the rabbis are the true royalty of the Jewish. Of the Jewish people. Rashi observes that, what does it mean, molech, that Rashi says that he was made the Rosh Yeshiva, right? And along with that came a certain amount of wealth, right? Not only did he achieve stature as the leading Torah figure, but he also merited to earn money. So Omri lo. So when Ilfa comes back after having been out as a merchant in the big wide world making a living, they say to him, I'ativ mar vagoris, if you had stayed and sat and learned and read and not gone out to make a living, lo have molich mar, maybe you would have become the Rosh Yeshiva. And you see the irony, of course. You left because you felt you needed to earn a living. Rabbi Yochanan remained and became great in Torah and also earned a living. He's not poor. He makes a nice parnasa. So, ozol tlat nafshei, ozol tlat nafshei ba'askarya desvinta. So Ilfa goes and he hangs himself, he suspends himself from the mast of the ship. Depending on which commentary you're looking at, it's the crow's nest at the top of the mast, or he lashes himself to, he's not hanging himself with a noose, God forbid, but he lashes himself to the ship's mast, you know, like Ulysses or something, but he's doing something high up at the top of the ship. So Omar, I ika de sho'ili bimatnita de Rabbi Chiya v'Rabbi Oshia, velo pashtina le mimatnitin, nafelna me askaria de svinta vitavana. If a single one of you can ask me something from any Brisa, from any Tosefta, and I can't answer you from the Mishnah, I will jump off this mast of this ship and I'll drown myself. Right? It's this kind of almost theatrical, pronouncement. Right? He says, you know, I dare you. You won't be able to find a single halacha. You won't be able to find a single matter in Torah that you're going to catch me on that I don't know. That I don't know it backwards and forward. But it's phrased in this way. There's this body of learning called the Torah Sheba'al Peh. Now, this is the first generation after. He is a first generation. He's either a last. You know, he's in that liminal period between the Tanaim and the Amoraim, right? He, Ilfa, was the first generation Amora. He was a student of Rabbi Yehuda Anossi, who composed the Mishnah, who codified the Mishnah, who turned it from Dvarim Shiba Al Peh to a written, a codified oral law, right? In other words, the irony of continuing to refer to it as the Torah Sheba Al Peh, the oral law, highlights the fact that it is no longer oral. Even the oral teachings that were not written down ultimately could not withstand the pressure, and become encoded in writing, meaning that which is not codified in the Mishnah gets codified in the Tosefta. The Tosefta is an appendix to the Mishnah. And that which is neither written and set in stone in the Mishnah and the Tosefta, but left, you know, merely as braitiot, these outside teachings, these non-codified teachings, well, that was the work of multiple generations of the Amoraim to nail down those braitiot and to introduce them as pieces of evidence which then become concretized as the DNA of what the Gemara is. Right? Well, how much of what we do in studying the Gemara is examining these teachings of the Braitiot? Right? I assume that someone has done this research. I assume Yehudi is looking it up right now if he doesn't know off the top of his head, as he seems to know lots of interesting things off the top of his head. Right? What percentage of the text of the Gemara is just braitiot? We can imagine a color-coded Gemara, right? Where all the different layers of text, I mean, there are people that have done this kind of work, right? Where we're going to highlight all of the braitiot in yellow. It would be a lot of the Gemara. So what does Ilfa say? Ilfa says, you ask me a braita. You ask me something from outside. You ask me something that hasn't been codified. And I will show you it's there in the Mishnah. I will show you that the teachings of my great Rebbe, Rebbe Yehuda Anossi, contain hafach bo v'hafach bo, it's all there. Any braisa that you will quote, I will show you where it's in the Mishnah, or where it's between the lines of the Mishnah. I will be able to do this work of incredible expertise, of bekiyut, of coalition of the entirety of the Torah Sheba'al Peh, and to show you how it's all this one coherent unit. It's this kind of, you know, like they have these, I don't know, what do they call those? The mind palace competitions, Right? Or I think I mentioned last week in passing, because of his passing, Rabbi Leibel Dulitz of the Yeshiva University High School, you know, who had one of these phenomenal memories, and you could quote any three or four words in a Rashi, and he would know where it was, or you could quote any three or four words in Shakespeare, and he would know, you know, which play, which act, which scene, which line, right? So, you know, or the pin test, you know, the idea that you could stick a pin through the Gemara and somebody who was real Bakias would be able to tell you what word it goes through on each page. You know, these types of stories, it doesn't matter whether they're apocryphal or not, right? Nobody would even make up an apocryphal story like that about our generation, because it's just, you know, an apocryphal story at least has to have some plausibility to it. You know, the tales of the righteous, right? Like, you believe that they could have done that, those righteous deeds. But, you know, but we don't have that. David, what is this you've posted?
It's a book I'm not familiar with, but it's by Shmuel Safrai, or it's edited by Shmuel Safrai, and there's a section here talking about the quotations in the Bavli Yerushalmi. It says about 40% of the quotations are from material that's not found in the Halachic Midrashim, and the other 60% are in Halachic Midrashim. I'm not sure exactly what we're looking for, but I think it's probably the closest I could find to something talking about the percentages of
Brit Torah. The Halachic Midrashim isn't the whole thing. You also have to count the Tosefta.
Right. So they mentioned that a little bit earlier. I mean, I'm just, you know, looking at it quickly. This article, well, I'm not sure it's by, is probably the Halachic Midrashim by Menachem Gahana. So this article might be something to look at to get some ideas.
And Ezra Tzion Malama did a lot of work on that also. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so he's standing there. He's hanging there from the mast. He's hanging there from the mast. The mast. Here. Let me just view. Ata hahu saba. A certain Zayde comes along, an old man comes along. Now, I mean, you have to presume that the presence of this man, that the fact that he's an old man, is significant for the story. Would there be any difference? What difference does it make? The guy who asks him the question, does it make a difference whether he's an old man, he's a saba, he represents the older generation, or if it's a young man? I don't know. What do you think? No?
And to jump ahead, it seems to be talking about a case where it's talking about a case of somebody, of an old man. So maybe that's why. Not talking about the significance for Ilfa, but maybe just because the example he's giving is talking about an old man who's, if the case is relevant to him.
Right. Although a young man could have brought the same case. It's a case of inheritance that we're about to examine. So this ata hahu saba, a certain grandfather comes along, Tanale, and he presents the following brisa. Ha'omer, tnu shekel livnai b'shabbat, v'hein ruyin letet lehem sela, notnim lehem sela. A man is giving instructions, presumably a man, you know, maybe on his deathbed, or, you know, someone who's writing out his last will and testament, is giving instructions to the, what do you call that, the people, the executors of his estate.
Apotropos.
The apotropos, right? That's what I said, an executor.
We're looking for the standard rabbinic word for executor.
So he's giving instructions for how his orphaned children should be cared for. So if he says every week, Shabbat here means Shavuah, doesn't mean do it on Yom HaShvi'i. He says every week you should give my kids an allowance of one shekel. But if the apotropos, the executors of the estate, see that the children are in need of a sela, meaning two shkalim, maybe, you know, they have expenses that the father didn't anticipate. The costs of living have gone up, and you can't support yourself on one shekel a week. So the father says, make sure to give my kids, $50 a week. And when it comes time to actually do the estate, it costs $100 a week for the kids to take care of themselves. So you should give them, the higher sum. Why? Because presumably what the father meant by saying give them a shekel or give them $50 or give them X, you know, set sum, right? They were meaning give them, you know, a week's salary, a week's allowance to live on. And when he set that number on his deathbed or in his will, that's what he meant. He didn't mean, you know, only give that. Right? I remember when I was a kid, we got $1.50 for lunch money. Because $1.50 was enough to buy lunch. It was $2. It was $2. Because $2 you could buy lunch. You could go to the pizzeria and a slice of pizza was 75 cents. So two slices was $1.50 and a Coke was 50 cents. Right? I mean, some of you think that that doesn't make me old, because you can remember when it was even less. But today, if you tell a kid you get two slices of pizza and a Coke for $2, that seems like a pretty good deal. You can't even get one Coke for $2, let alone a slice of pizza. And if, or you could go to like the sandwich shop and you can get a sandwich, and a drink for $2. Right? So in other words, that's what they said. But like today, if I said to my kid today, you get $2 for lunch, that's your allowance. Right? Because that's what I got. They would say you're crazy. You can't do anything with $2. Right? So what it meant was you should give a person the amount they need to live on. Which is why the executors are allowed to raise the amount. Even though generally speaking, mitzvah l'kayem divrei hamet, we'll see. Generally speaking, the instructions of the deceased should be followed to the letter of the law. So what is this really a debate about? The letter of the law or the spirit of the law? The literal statement that the man makes or the intention he's trying to achieve by giving this instruction? But imamar, al titnu lahem ela shekel. If he phrases it in a much more explicit way, do not give them a penny more than a shekel. Ein notnim lehem ela shekel. Then, doesn't matter what the cost of living does, it doesn't matter how much the cost of a slice of pizza is, then it is a set sum and the executors cannot deviate from there. Im amar, im metu, and this is where it becomes interesting, if he says to the executors, if my heirs should die, yirshu acherim tachtehim, bein she'amar tnu, bein she'amar al titnu. Whether he said, give them a shekel, or he said, do not give them a penny more than a shekel, ein notnim lehem ela shekel, then you can only give the children a shekel. Meaning he sets up an inheritance. In the first case, it's a normal case. In a normal case, the parents die, the children inherit. The children have the money. They then determine what happens in the future generation. Because in the normal course of things, grandchildren should not be inheriting from their grandparents. Everybody should have arichas yamim, everybody should have a good long life, everybody should have parnasa, and supply and provide for their families. The grandparents should be concerned to give money over to their children, that generation, the sandwich generation should give over to the next generation, and so on and so forth. But if the man making out his will and testament understands that maybe there's a reason he has to be providing for the generation after, so then, the middle generation, his children, the second generation, they only get the limited amount. They only get the exact shekel and not a penny more. In that case, the executors have no wiggle room to up the amount according to the cost of living or the cost of a slice of pizza. Omar le hamani. So Ilfa asks the old man, Mani, whose opinion is this? Whose opinion is this? Rebbe Meir he. It is Rebbe Meir's opinion. You just said a brisa, old Zaidi, old Saba. I will tell you where it appears in the Mishnah. This brisa that you just told me about inheritance law and from one generation to another generation or from one generation to skipping a generation to providing for the grandchildren's generation. This is the opinion of Rebbe Meir. Da Omer Rebbe Meir, mitzvah l'kayem divrei hamit. Rebbe Meir said that there is an obligation to fulfill the will and testament of he who has passed, of he who has passed on. That's the end of the Ilfa Agada. Now, how do we make sense of this? Well, first of all, does anybody have any interesting insights to this Agada?
Now I'd like to say something.
Yes.
Can you see me?
We can see you. Well, at least we can see you from the nose down.
Okay. I think one of the main things that hit me with this Agada was the fact that, given the fact that both of these people were in poverty, it's hard to say that they're trying to earn enough money to support themselves is Manichim Chai Olam Yoskim Chai Shah. Right off the bat, that's very questionable. On top of that, what I think is even more interesting here is that in the end, it turns out that Ilfa really is just as knowledgeable as every other one as he was when the thing started. So it's very clear that it's perfectly possible to be Mefarnes yourself and keep up your Torah learning. And in fact, that's a much more desirable way of doing things than to rely upon other people to be Mefarnes you. Okay? I don't really see any place where the text says befarush that Rav Yochanan got enriched, you know,
malachi. No, I said very clearly that was Rashi's interpretation, but we do know from later Agadot of Rabbi Yochanan, that Rabbi Yochanan had Ala Milas. He had position, he had wealth, and he had great good looks. He was very handsome.
Yeah, that's right. The good looks part we've all heard. But the part about the wealth, all I'm saying with this is that it's more mechubad to support yourself than to have other people, and especially the students of the yeshiva, who themselves are certainly not exactly on a very elevated level.
I don't think Rabbi Yochanan's wealth came from the yeshiva students, right? It was.
Well, that certainly sounds like that, because it says that the students are the ones who put him out. Why are you asking secondary things? Like I said, it's not in the text itself. The main point here is very much in the text. Ilfa has lost a grain of his Torah learning, despite the fact that he's not doing it full time. And it seems to me that out of this story, you get one thing. It's very clear: you do better with Torah if you don't do it full time. Okay.
So you read this Gemara as a kind of testament to Torah im Derech Eretz.
I think the fact that he's standing, he's thought of his
I don't use the term Derech Eretz. I use the term malacha. V'chol Torah she'eini ma malacha, so ba b'teila v'gorer zava. Period.
Sharon, you wanted to say something?
I tried. Yes, the fact that he's standing on the mast of a ship, and not just, you know, sitting in the Beis Midrash or something, makes the point that it's Torah v'avodah. Yeah, that he can work and still learn Torah.
Meaning the ship being the symbol of his wealth, right?
Yeah.
Like he's in other words, in a different Agada, we could see somebody like standing in the center of the trading floor on Wall Street.
Yeah. Well, the point is that people do a lot more Torah study today than they ever did in Europe, despite the way we're brainwashed to the contrary. Because people have more time.
Well,
you know, the Rambam says it's very important for a person to strive to get as much wealth as possible to support themselves in order so that they'll have time left over to learn Torah.
Right.
And the fact is, just the very thing like your web yeshiva, the person is sitting and basically barely making their parnasa, they usually are not going to have time to sit in on class. I mean, they're just barely surviving, you know? So the result of that is that, if anything, the fact that people's income level and standard of living has risen has been wonderful for Torah study. It's made a lot more people sit down and learn.
Well, I would say you've said two things that don't necessarily agree with each other. It's true that many more, the democratization of learning. First of all, the democratization of education. You mentioned Europe, meaning Eastern Europe, and you also mentioned the Rambam. These are, of course, very different times and very different milieu. We can't talk about the Rambam and, let's say, the Yeshiva of Volozhin in the same breath. We're talking about completely different realities. It is true. We all know very well the Rambam's idea of how you should spend your time, and halavai any of us could.
The Rambam wasn't looking at Bialik under the pages of the Gemara.
Right. But the Rambam had a full schedule in addition to his other accomplishments in learning,
exactly.
And on top of his responsibilities in communal leadership and other things. But certainly, let's say in Eastern Europe from the 19th beginning of the 19th century until the end of Eastern European Jewry, as it was known in its heyday. There were people, of course, who learned incredible amounts, who were Yoshev Yomam Valaila 24/7 sitting and learning, but there were very, 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 very few of them. When we think of this romantic idea of the Yeshiva Volozhin, when we think of, you mentioned Bialik, when we think of, like, you know, Bialik's Matmid, right? So if you've ever been to the Yeshiva of Volozhin, like, we imagine the Yeshiva of Volozhin, like, I don't know, this great university, this phenomenal institution, this. If you've ever been there, or even if you've just seen photographs of the building, it's tiny, right? The whole Volozhin Yeshiva could fit inside the building that our shul is in, with room to spare. Right? It was a tiny building. There were never more than a certain number of people. The smallest yeshiva today, I'm exaggerating, but the smaller yeshivot today are bigger than Volozhin. And there are hundreds times more of them. Today. So the democratization of learning, certainly at the elementary school and high school levels, very few people went off to Volozhin. You went to Cheder for a couple of years. By you, I meant the boys. The girls, of course, got no formal education. The fact that women today are educated already includes 50% of the population that were automatically cut off. But you went to Cheder for a couple of years, and then that was it. You didn't continue, either because you didn't have the proclivities for ongoing Torah study, or because there was no financial scenario by which you could afford, or your family could afford, to do that. Only the true Iluyim and those with wealth were able to go on and to continue their study, you know, the equivalent of what we think of as high school, and later, and to go off to the yeshivot. So there are just many, 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 many more people today that have the opportunity to learn, in addition to the conveniences that are then opened to people who are adult learning, people that are out there in the workplace that have opportunity to learn. Yes, through technology, but through the fact, even before the internet, through the fact that you had a solid grounding in a primary and secondary education that enabled you to go on to be lifelong learners. But people that only had a couple of years of cheder under their belt and spent their days in backbreaking labor as water drawers and wood choppers and shoemakers and merchants and whatnot, well, how are they going to be learning? You know, if they were amongst the committed, they would go off and join the chevrat tilim, and between minch and maariv, they would say some of the psalms. So yes,
what about Rabbi Yehoshua?
What?
Rabbi Yehoshua. You know, when Tamiel goes around and he finds he was a chocobo. What?
Right. I'm sorry. There's crosstalk here. I'm not hearing what you're saying.
Rabbi Yehoshua, when Rabbi Gamliel goes around to this place and he finds that the house is all black,
right?
Because
he's surprised. He says, "Pechmiata, you." Right. Yeah, but I was talking. I mean, you're talking. You're bringing me a case from the. You're bringing me a case from the Mishnah. I'm talking about the 19th century, right? You know, it's even more so. So yes, I think that this story shows, and Ilfa seems to be quite sensitive to this fact. You think that I'm not good. They say to him, you could have been great. You could have been a contender. If you had not gone off to work, you could have been the greatest sage of the generation. And he says, what's the subtext here? Do you think I didn't continue my learning? I'll do the pin test. Put the pin through the Gemara. I can tell you what word it goes through. Name any brisa. I can connect it to its place in the Mishnah. And is he saying that my learning, my work, did not come at the expense of my greatness in learning? But the particular example he gives, I think, is quite telling. There's the inside, and there's the outside. There's the codified, and there's the fluid. Particularly in an era before the Braytiot were written down in the manner that we have them. He's making a conversation about those that stay inside. I mean, this is my idea. Maybe others say this. I don't know. I didn't see it anywhere. This is my idea of why this is the kind of test that he gives. Right? He's saying, name anything on the outside. Name anything that hasn't been codified and written down and concretized. And I will show you that all of those braytiot, all of those things that are out there in the big wide world, that aren't between two covers on a shelf or written down in a scroll or however the Torah Shebaal Peh was written, and inside the Beit Midrash, the two are connected. In other words, what is he saying? He's saying, yes, I was out there. I myself was a Braita. I didn't get set in the Beit Midrash like my friend Yochanan, who became a Mishnah. But I will show you that you can be a Braita and a Mishnah. I will show you that this is all one unified world. And even if I'm out there, where there are dangers. A ship at sea is a dangerous thing. And I'm going to occupy the highest rung in that order. At the top of the mast, I am nevertheless still rooted and anchored on the inside. Pardon the pun of using the image of the anchor. Right? But that might be connected here. Others have observed the idea that I'm sorry, I muted everyone because there was a lot of cross chatter. You can unmute yourself if you want to say something. Others have observed the idea that the idea to be at a ship at sea, right? So the sea is, of course, this very prominent. This prominent image of trade, of mercantilism. We remember the idea of Zvulun and Yisachar together, but Zvulun, whose symbol, of course, is the ship at sea, the merchant, the one who's making money in order to support Yisachar, the scholar back at home. But the sea is also, of course, the sea of Talmud, right? The Yama Talmud. and that his sailing off on the sea of mercantilism did not necessarily come at the expense of his voyages on the sea of Talmud. It's important to remember that I think it was actually Davar B'Shem Omro. It was Professor David Hartman who. These are my recollection of the quote, but it goes something like this. We talk about, it was in the context of talking about teaching, particularly teaching younger students. We talk about immersing them in the Sea of Talmud. But normally what we do is immerse them in the bathtub of Talmud. In both cases, you come out wet, but they are categorically different experiences. A bathtub is limited. It's bound. It's not much bigger than you are. What? I mean, except for tiny little kids, you know, for whom the bathtub is like a swimming pool, for a young adult and for a grown adult, a bathtub is big enough to get in, to get your body in, to get wet, to dunk, and to come out. What? But you have no room to move about. The voyage on the Yam HaTalmud is not even properly thought of as one on a ship. Chazal, of course, had no ability to, no imaginative frame to think of a sea voyage as anything but going on a wooden sailing ship. But the true vessel of the Sea of Talmud is not a ship, but a submarine, said Hartman. Because submarines can travel on the surface, or they can go deep. They can travel in all different directions, and you're brought to all different types of places. Right? It's not just lateral movement. It's not just horizontal movement. It's vertical movement as well. We know that you can learn Bekias. We know that you can learn Be'iyun. So it's much more useful to think of the journey on the Sea of Talmud as a submarine journey rather than a proper ship. But for the image of Ilfa, we relate to the ship. In the beginning of the Gemara, it's interesting. Rabbi Yochanan and Ilfa, these two young students, they begin together. They're study partners. We will see soon when we get to the Choni HaMagel stories in Dapim, the well known line O Chevruta O Mituta, right? The bond between the two study partners and how that's formed. They come to this life decision together. They decide it is time for them to leave. It is time for them to leave the yeshiva. They are on the same path at all moments until this, what Rabbi Yochanan understands, is a divine intervention. Now, Yehudi, you seem to understand that also as a divine intervention. And you question how could divine justice act this way to even suggest a death penalty on somebody who's going to go out to earn a living to support himself. Well, it depends on how you understand what these angels are and what they're doing. There's a very nice recent book that came out from Professor Moshe Sokol at Touro College called The Snake at the Mouth of the Cave. It's readings of different agadot in the Bavli. And he has a material on our story as well, which I commend to your attention. He points out that the Rambam in the Mor Nevuchim, in Chelek Bet, in the second book of the Mor Nevuchim, chapter 6, as part of a long conversation about what malachim are, what angels are, and the Rambam, in his rationalism and in his anti-mystical kind of approach to things, basically suggests that malachim, that angels, are really not much more than these. This is not the Rambam's terms, but basically what he's saying, you know, not to be too Freudian about it, is that the malachim are really not much more than our own subconscious speaking to us. The malachim are different types of psychic forces. Yeah, the Rambam says that the angels are individual, natural, and psychic forces are called angels. That's what the Rambam says in the Mor Nevuchim. So if the angels are really just our own inner voices guiding us, either to sin or to virtue. So what's going on in the story? Only one of them hear the angels. Only Rabbi Yochanan hears it. So in a kind of Maimonidean way, we can say Rabbi Yochanan is hearing what he wants to be hearing. Rabbi Yochanan is hearing, go back to yeshiva. The voyage outside is perilous. In other words, he hears something which will convince him of what he wants to be doing in all cases. Ilfa doesn't hear it because that's not his own subconscious. Ilfa understands the Pasuk says, you shouldn't be poor. And if you're not wealthy and you can't support yourself otherwise, you have to go out and work. And if you have to go out and work, it takes time to work. And the time that you're working, well, you can't be studying. Lo alecha hamlacha ligmor v'lo ata bin chorim li batel mimenu. You still have to learn. You still have to become a great scholar, but you have to learn on the side. Sleep fast. Right? You know, if you learn how to sleep fast, you can accomplish much more. You can work and learn. That's what the Rambam says. Right? The Rambam says, yeah, of course you have to work full time, but you still have to learn 8 hours a day. The Rambam didn't have Netflix, you understand. He was able to imagine such a scenario. There is, of course, something interesting in the use of these psukim from Shemitah. The psukim in Shemitah are talking about Shemitat Ksafim, that we relinquish the loans that are needed in order to as part of the whole financial system of the Shemitah. But it's also talking about a time once every 7 years, basically in which the economy gets frozen, where everyone is provided for, and the people that are engaged in the backbreaking labor of agriculture are able to take a year and dedicate themselves to spiritual pursuits. So there's a kind of irony here that they're marshaling the psukim of Shemitah, which might actually mean much more, don't work, but go and learn. But in their context, it comes to take on the opposite meaning, right? The proof texts that they're citing are being used in order to justify leaving Torah study in order to go out to work. That's not uncommon, that a proof text will be taken out of its context in order to go. But it is, of course, surprising. I think I observed this last week. They say, okay, we're going to go out, we're going to work. This is before the arrival of the angels. And what do they say? Look at this energetic statement. Nikum v'nizal v'naved iska v'nekayim b'nafshein. We're going to get up and we're going to go and we're going to work and we're going to fulfill. And then what do? The second they walk out of the yeshiva, they sit down under this wall, which is, of course, the subject of how we get to this Gemara, and they don't do anything. They take out their sandwiches. And that's how they potentially get into trouble. I mean, that might reflect their own ambivalence at what they're doing. I mean, it certainly seems to reflect Rabbi Yochanan's ambivalence. But it might also reflect, because Rabbi Yochanan in the end gives up on the idea and he turns around and goes back to yeshiva. But it might also reflect on Ilfa's ambivalence. The fact that Ilfa forges ahead and finds success in business and does so without compromising or sacrificing his learning does not mean that there was not discomfort, that there wasn't ambivalence, there wasn't a little anxiety when he set off to do it. And that might be the meaning of, let's get up, let's go, up and at 'em, and we're, you know, hurry up and wait. At that point, they head off on different paths. At that point, they're set in different in different directions. Ilfa's idea that he nevertheless has complete mastery over everything shows that unity of text and of subtext of you know what he's doing and what's happening. The idea that the sugya that's brought in as the test case, I mean, you could have brought anything from any of the Shisha Sidre Mishnah, right? As the brisa that the old man or a young man or whomever throws at Ilfa to put him to the test. The fact that it's this sugya about inheritance and what one generation passes to the next is an interesting one. Now, Sokol, Moshe Sokol, in the essay that I told you, reads it in one way, which is interesting, but I don't find completely convincing. If you'd like, I can send you the chapter and you can see it for yourself. But I'd like to take his idea and spin it around and say something else. He says, the question is put to him by a Saba. Saba is probably just a generic term meaning an old man, right? But we should take it in its conventional sense of a grandfather. You only get to be a Saba if you have two generations waiting online after you. Right? That's the definition of what it means to be a Saba. Rabbi Soloveitchik has a beautiful essay called The First Jewish Grandfather about how Judaism, I mean, presumably all grandfathers, Jewish and non-Jewish, all grandmothers, Jewish and non-Jewish, feel that sense of connection to the generations. But in the context of the Masorah and giving over tradition, he makes a big deal about what it means to be a Jewish grandfather. I'm certain this was an idea that he only came to once he became a grandfather himself. It's in the volume, Reflections of the Rav. To be a grandfather is to have an awareness that there's a third generation, that your children have children, and that what you have been working so hard to do with your children now has continuity going on to another generation. As my parents often point out, grandparents and grandchildren have such a special bond because they have a common enemy. What is the teaching of that Braita? If the father says to the executor, give my children one shekel, but the children need more than that, the executor has the discretion to raise the sum. Which means, of course, that the money is going to run out quicker. If the father says, give my children only X and not a penny more, then the executors are blocked in. It's a set sum. They can't do anything regardless of what's happening in the economy. If, however, the father says, give my children X, and I make a provision for the generation that comes after, I am not merely handing down one generation, I am making provisions for everything that will come after, then the executors have to be very careful in parceling out the amount. Because if they increase the amount given per week to the children, that doesn't only mean that the sum will be exhausted sooner, it comes at the expense of what the next generation is going to get. So it becomes very significant that it's a Saba, it's an old man who's asking this, who throws this as the source to challenge Ilfa. Because he's somebody that understands. If he's a Saba, he understands that his responsibility in passing the tradition, it has to be done very carefully. It has to be portioned out. You can't be indiscriminate about how you spend it, because it has to go the distance. It has to provide not just for my children, it has to provide for my children's children. And I, the Saba, know what that means. Tzvi, I think you're sending me a copy of that thing, but you should post it to the chat in the group. So maybe the Saba mentions this to Ilfa, because he says, Ilfa, if you feel connected to the Torah, if you feel that you have that kind of expertise, you have to spend it carefully. You have to know that it has to go the distance. Now, you can interpret that in different ways. I think Sokol interprets it somewhat uncharitably. He turns Ilfa into something of a failure instead of kind of the hero of the story. But I think you can read it the other way. Right? He could be saying, Ilfa, you can make a contribution to Torah even as a merchant. And I don't mean the kind of normal way we think of the merchant. The merchant's job is to pay the money to keep the lights on in the yeshiva. No. You are as great a sage as any other. And it's all the more remarkable because you achieved that wisdom while still out there working all day. But you have to know how to spend it. You have to know that it has to go the distance. You have to know that it has to have an impact not just on the next generation, but on the generations after. And your impact has to be not just in the Torah that you know, but in the whole gestalt of your personality. In this kind of, I said Torah im derech eretz, Yehudi said Torah im malacha, we could say Torah umada, choose whichever slogan works for you, but they're all overlapping ideas, right? That's something which is hard to do, and it's a very, very hard model to be morish. But maybe this is the real challenge, of being, right? What does it mean to be hanging at the balance on the top of a ship, you know, swaying at sea? It's a really hard balancing act. But somehow, Ilfa, you managed to do that. But you have to be very careful in passing that along very deliberately and not haphazardly, otherwise the whole Yerusha will be spent. But if you intend on having an impact for many generations, you have to be Morish, you have to pass on the inheritance of what it is that you've been doing in this careful way. I see that we've gone over time. There's more to be said on this. I think there's also more to be said about Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan disappears from the story. He becomes the Rosh Hashiva, that's it. And then we turn our attention back to Ilfa. But we know other things about Rabbi Yochanan. And we know other things about Rabbi Yochanan's relationship with his other chavrusas. And there is something to be said here on the Rabbi Yochanan-Ilfa relationship in light of Rabbi Yochanan's later-in-life relationship with Reish Lakish, another great Chevruta, who also is a kind of insider-outsider, right? But of a very different way. Perhaps I'll just make a few remarks about that next week when we pick up. But we will end here for the night, and we will continue next week. Next week, we move on to the Agadah of Nachum Ish Gamzu Latova. And we'll pick up there. Okay, Laila Tov.